accuracy errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, Food and Water Watch senior lobbyist Tony Corbo will address ongoing concerns with a proposal to change federal poultry inspections. Then, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel and TSA Local 1120 Montana Vice President Eric Wood will discuss the dangers of privatization in the federal government. Lastly, AFGE DOD Local 2142 President Joe Gonzalez will discuss the union's work on behalf of its members. Tony Corbo, senior lobbyist with Food and Water Watch, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tony, as you know, last week here on Inside Government, we reported on the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service proposal to implement a new inspection system for poultry slaughter plants. Tell us about the proposal and your reaction to it.
Well, what the proposal essentially does is it begins the process of privatizing inspection and turning more inspection over the companies and have the companies police themselves. When the proposal is fully implemented, we're looking at the elimination of some 800 inspector positions. It will save USDA $90 million in wage and benefit costs. But interestingly enough, the industry, the poultry industry, stands to gain $260 million in cost savings because they will be allowed to increase line speeds, even though there are going to be fewer government inspectors in the plants.
Tony, let's talk about those line speeds a little bit. Where are they now, and where is the proposal trying to take them?
Well, the line speeds now, they do vary in the various poultry plants, but essentially each USDA inspector on the carcass line is responsible for looking up to 35 birds per minute, and that's still pretty fast. But they're able to detect any fecal contamination. They're able to look at all sides of the bird inside the poultry carcass. But now under this proposal, they'll eliminate all poultry inspectors on the line except for one. They will have what they call an offline inspector who will do verification activities, but the line speeds will be increased to 175 birds a minute. So if you have one poultry inspector, USDA poultry inspector online, he or she will be responsible for looking at 175 birds per minute. That person is not going to be able to detect anything. And what they're doing is turning over what they call some of the quality issues. They call the term of art that they use is other consumer protection. So if through the scalding process not enough feathers come off, or because of the way the machines are set up in these poultry plants, the evisceration process is not complete, so you still have intestines hanging out, you know, from the carcass. It'll be up to the company employees at 175 birds a minute to detect those defects and to pull those birds off the line.
Tony, are the companies prepared to accept this challenge?
They're not, and the USDA has had in mind for over 13 years going to this system. So they did institute a pilot project in 1998 with about two dozen poultry plants. And we, Food and Water Watch, back in August, anticipating that the agency was going to expand the pilot to all poultry plants, decided to take a look at the track record of most of the poultry plants under the pilot program. And what we found, and again, the line speeds are in excess of 150, 175. There was one plant under the pilot program that for a period of time was operating at 200 birds per minute. What we found was that the company employees were missing a lot of the quality defects. The USDA inspector who was assigned to do verification activities in these plants was taking a sample of, let's say, 80 birds a day on a particular line, and they would do checks to see if the company employees were catching the quality defects, and they weren't. There was one turkey plant in particular in Indiana where 99% of the birds failed the quality check for feathers or intestines still being in the poultry in the turkey carcass. So the company employees are not catching these defects, and it's because two things: primarily because the line speeds are so fast. Second of all, the company employees are not trained. They're not trained. They are not trained to do the job of a USDA inspector. And this current proposal, where the agency wants to expand the pilot to all poultry plants, all the agency is saying is that they will provide guidance to the industry on how the employees, the company employees, will be trained to assume the USDA inspection activities. That's not enough. They have to be certified to do those jobs before they're putting consumers at risk with poultry that is contaminated going into commerce.
Tony, this sounds like there are a number of safety concerns with this. In particular, you had mentioned that right now an inspector looks at every single bird on the line, which sounds very reasonable and almost expected for food quality and safety purposes. Where does this take us by abandoning that inspection process now?
We're going to see a reduction in the food safety by eliminating that visual inspection. There seems to be an arrogance, especially within the management of the agency, that visual inspection is passé. We don't need that because of the fact that, you know, the companies have mechanized the system in the slaughter facilities, and they're more concerned to make sure that salmonella rates are down. What's been happening is that these companies that have been operating under the pilot project have been dousing the poultry in chlorine. There's one product called TSP, trisodium phosphate, which is essentially used as an industrial cleaner for concrete, and that kills the salmonella. But that's what we're doing. We're industrializing our food supply, and even with the application of these interventions, as they call them, there's still going to be contaminated product going into the marketplace because, number one, you're not going to have the USDA inspector there to make sure that there's no fecal contamination on those carcasses. Number two, the line speeds are going so fast that we're not going to be able to really check to see if adulterated product is going into the marketplace.
Tony, what's your biggest concern about this proposal?
The biggest concern is that there are going to be food safety issues that are going to arise from this. We're going to have company employees assuming the jobs of trained USDA inspectors. The company employees are not going to be trained. They're going to increase the line speed to such a rate that we're not going to be able to detect any contamination on those carcasses. And we're really demeaning the role of the USDA inspector. These inspectors are very dedicated public employees. I've worked with them for over 10 years. They work in some of the most wretched conditions of any public employee I have ever run into. I mean, they're in these slaughter facilities. In the winter, the places, you know, the slaughter facilities are not heated properly. In the summer, they're working in 105, 120 degree heat. They're slogging through animal blood, feces, animal parts, and to turn the responsibility of these dedicated public employees, trained public employees, over to unqualified company employees is putting the public at risk.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com, joined here by Tony Corbo, a senior lobbyist with Food and Water Watch. Tony, what then is the response? What's Food and Water Watch doing? What are the consumers saying about this?
Well, there's an open comment period right now on this proposed regulation. The comment period is due to expire April the 26th. So we're Food and Water Watch, in preparation, for that, is developing our comments. We did, through the Freedom of Information Act request, we did publish the results of our analysis of the track record of the plants that were already in the pilot program, which is abysmal. I mean, it is abysmal. And so that's going to be incorporated as part of our comments. And we're working with some of the other consumer organizations to develop a concerted set of comments that we can, weigh in with the agency. The other thing is, the agency is holding a meeting. It's supposed to be a public teleconference on the 21st of March. And I would encourage any of your listeners to listen into that teleconference. It's supposed to be open to the public. The consumer groups are going to voice concerns about the proposed rule to the agency during that teleconference, and anyone else who wants to do so should be encouraged to listen in and also to register comments during that teleconference.
Tony, what's the impact here on employees and their safety in the plant? Some of these inspectors who are charged with examining countless birds per minute.
Well, first of all, the USDA inspectors do an awful lot of manual work in these plants as they're checking the carcasses, and it's ironic that when the agency decided to last year to start moving forward with the expansion of the pilot, one of the arguments that was being advanced by some of the members of Congress who are beholden to the poultry industry, and I'll name names: Congressman Jack Kingston, the chairman of the Agriculture Appropriations Subcommittee, was the one who was really pushing the agency to expand the pilot. One of the arguments he was making is that we'll be able to reduce workers' comp costs by not having the inspectors do some of these manual checks on the carcasses and turning the responsibilities over to the company employees. Well, I mean, so the company employees now are going to be the ones who are going to be injured by having to manually touch these birds. The other thing is that the meat and poultry industry is notorious for having a bad worker safety record. Company employees are injured because they're using knives, and while these birds are going by at a very fast rate as they're processing the birds, it's only those injuries are going to be exacerbated. There's a lot of carpal tunnel syndrome. There's a lot of repetitive motion injuries in the poultry industry. And the agency and the industry will say, well, the OSHA records show, well, the injury rates are not that high. Well, the problem is that a lot of the company employees are reticent to report injuries. You do have a large immigrant population that works in these plants. They do not want to rock the boat. This is their only job. And so we have insisted all along that before they move ahead with this pilot project, that they do have, they need to do an independent worker safety study in those plants, and this is not a new proposal. Senator, the late Senator Ted Kennedy wanted that done back in 2005 when there were reports that there were the injury rates in meat and poultry slaughter facilities were actually a lot higher than what the OSHA record showed. And so we've insisted that the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health come in and do a comprehensive study of worker safety issues in those poultry plants before they turn these responsibilities over to company employees and increase the line speeds to 175 birds per minute.
Tony Corbo, senior lobbyist with Food and Water Watch. Tony, thank you for your time, and please come back and keep us updated on this issue.
Well, I'm happy to do it. This is an important fight, and I hope your entire AFSCME membership is paying attention.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel will address the dangers of prison privatization.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Dale Desotel, the president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, recently the council spoke out in opposition to the Corrections Corporation of America's Corrections Investment Initiative, which is an attempt to privatize some government prison facilities. Dale, tell us about that and your reaction.
My reaction to that announcement that came from Harley Lappin, who was recently hired by that corporation from the Bureau of Prisons, where he had retired, did not strike me as something that I didn't foresee. Harley Lappin was, as the CEO of the Bureau of Prisons, in charge of all contracts, in charge of all promotions of executives, and certainly has all knowledge of the contracts that we were currently involved with the corporation that he now is employed by. And so, therefore, I know that's why they hired him, because of the connections that he has with the prison system and already contracts that were still alive and in force with them. So, this attempt to attract the business nationwide, although he claims it's only state level, is an attempt to gain a monopoly on the prison system. Prisons for profit is what we refer to it in the Bureau of Prisons as labor activists. So I was not surprised, but I'm totally against, because the obvious reason is my suggesting the prison for profit issue. They will pay their people less. I read something yesterday where some local person mentioned that they want to, the state wants to sell the prisons. I think it's Louisiana, my home state, and that the employees would be paid much less, so it would be a lot cheaper to privatize it. So we're going backwards in the union activists arena, as this corporation, or as some would have it, to reduce levels of pay, to reduce the standard of living for Americans. So it's outrageous. That's what it is.
And as we understand it, Dale, the CCA plan is to purchase and operate state prisons under the qualifications that the facility to be sold would have at least 1,000 beds, is filled to at least 90% capacity, and then that the state would agree to pay CCA to operate the facility for a minimum of 20 years. What's the danger in privatizing government-run prisons?
The danger is the old saying, you get what you pay for. They pay their employees much less. Their less standards of security that we as federal Bureau of Prisons employees from the Department of Justice, federal law enforcement officers, are held to a tremendously high standard compared to what they are held to. It has been proven that they have had issues. They have lost control of several institutions. They've actually lost some contracts because they couldn't maintain over the years. So they haven't proven to be cheaper. They haven't proven to be more effective, and they haven't proven to be more safe. And that's what we claim.
How does it make you feel, Dale, as a correctional officer who's part of the most professional and highly trained correctional workforce in the world? How does it make you feel to see attempts to steer business away from professionals like yourself and into hands that might not be as capable?
Well, it seems to be the trend of this country to move away from government services. Our positions have always been recognized as inherently governmental, and so it's disrespectful, for one, and it's actually a cohort operation. I'll use that word because the agenda here is to make money. The agenda here is not to make any prison safer or any community safer. The agenda here is prisons for profit, and that they achieve that profit by paying less for the people who actually do the work. And the inmates are not programmed. We, as the Federal Bureau of Prisons, are mandated to offer many programs. And, you know, that's expensive. But the programs offered there, I'm sure they offer some, but they do not pay the wages that are paid, so the standard of living is less. So, therefore, the danger of an inmate approaching a staff member or an officer to introduce contraband is 100 times more, because the person's not making any income. I mean, it's hard to make a living on that standard.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Dale Desotel, the president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, talk about the community risk here at play for prisons that might not be as safe as, say, a federal prison in a community.
Our mission as the Bureau of Prisons is not only to maintain the incarceration of the individual placed under our care, but also to maintain their safety and to keep them safe from each other. And then once you lose that control, then you're looking at losing control in the community. I remember situations with these private prisons where they totally lost control out in Texas near the Big Springs area. And then once that happened, the agency, Bureau of Prisons, had to step in and go in and take the prison back and get control of the situation. And then we had to pay for all of the damages. So how is that saving people money? How is that helping the community? How is it keeping them safe? You know, if you hire people in your community for the Bureau of Prisons and you pay them the money that we pay them, or even pay them better, you know, as they grow in their tenure, they are active participants and active people that live there in that community, and they participate in all of the schools and all of the activities that are involved, and the place becomes safer. Whereas you have someone driving in, you know, that may not make the same amount of wages, they have no incentive to stay there, to build there, to build a community.
Dale, let's take a look inside a federal prison and tell us what it's like to work there. What are the conditions like? What are the challenges that the officers face on a day-to-day basis?
When I started 26 years ago, it was I was quite impressed with the agency. I was quite impressed with the way the agency functioned. I was impressed with the way people treated me, other officers. I was impressed with the way the inmates responded to us and respected us overall. We are officers, and we do maintain the custody of them, but their issue was never with us for many years. They never had an issue with Dale Desotel. Their issue was with the courts or with the laws or you know, the fact that they were incarcerated. Today, their frustrations can be taken out on the person that's in the wrong place at the wrong time, because they're frustrated behind overcrowding, they're frustrated behind the laws, frustrated behind the new law that causes them to do the maximum amount of time that goes with the sentencing, frustrated about the fact that we don't have the people to, the staffing levels are lower than they were, and so we're stretched thin, and so we really can't perform our duties as far as keeping them safe. I've actually heard inmates say, lock me up, y'all can't keep me safe, or send me to another place because y'all can't keep me safe. You know, and so that's some of those concerns are safety for the inmates, their own safety. And so when they contemplate getting attacked or assaulted, the officers have to deal with it. And we have to, you know, stop those assaults. And in the event, sometimes and many times, most times, we get injured. So our safety is on the line from the time we walk in the door until the time we leave.
And you have no protective equipment either, right? You're just equipped
with... We have radios. We have no pepper spray. We have been offered stab-proof vests, but those are outdated. We have to try to get those replaced. We have no weapons. We don't even have pepper spray that my wife carries in her purse that she bought at the local store. We cannot carry anything except a radio. We're at a disadvantage.
What would the impact be of acquiring some protective equipment on the job? How would that change some of the stresses possibly that a correctional officer is under day to day?
Well, our biggest push is to get back to the level of staffing that we once had, and that's been an up and down battle for the last 40 years. But in the event, even with those staffing increases, when an inmate knows that you have a weapon, if I know that you have a weapon, I may reconsider my attempt at taking my frustrations out on you. Because if I know I'm the only one that's got a weapon, then I don't mind going into that battle. But, you know, if I know you have one, then I have to consider the fact that I may get injured as well. So it's just common logic to anyone, to any human being, that they would have to weigh that prior to acting on their frustrations.
And Dale, when inmates know that the facility is understaffed, does that compound the situation? Does that make them more aggressive and more willing to participate in violence if they know that there aren't enough correctional officers there to take control?
You don't have to be an inmate to know that when the cat's away, the rats will play, right? There's obviously an increase in assaults, an increase in violence, and an increase in uprests in these prisons because of their frustrations, and they know there's no way that we can stop it. That we don't have the room. Most of the institutions were built with special housing units to deal with these people that were disruptive. And now, today, we house overflow of penitentiary inmates that have been in trouble or causing or being disruptive, and we have them housed in our own local special housing units. So therefore, that reduces the ability for us to take disciplinary action against inmates that are disruptive. So, yeah, when you know there's no highway patrolman on the highway, you might get to the ball game a little faster, right?
Dale, let's talk a little bit about the funding. Do you feel that the agency is properly funded to meet its needs?
To accomplish the goals that we have to accomplish, no. No. We are not properly funded. We are understaffed. We're not properly funded. We have no way to add housing units at this juncture. Of course, I don't know that anything's been proposed. The director did tell me he has proposed extra housing units, but nothing's been approved. So we have a total of about five that we have ability to open within the next 2 years. But, the amount of inmates we take in on a yearly basis, on the average in the last 10 years, has been, anywhere from 6,000 to 7,000. And so that would require at least 2 to 3 institutions overcrowded to handle those. And we're only opening 2 this year. So we're behind on the funding.
2012, what would you like to see there, Dale? More funding, more staffing? Do you think that it'll get done?
Well, the budget's already been approved for this year, and they've already, even if they had to build more. There's no time to get anything built. Maybe they could purchase the Thompson Institution in Illinois, and that could be activated, you know, within a certain amount of time. But even in the hiring process, we go through so much scrutiny because of our security level. It takes time to hire people. And I think that if they would raise the level that they bring these employees on, they would get more opportunities right away. But we want to hire them as cheap as we can, and that hurts your options, you know. But if that, I thought and I suggested that he raise the level of the people that are coming on, and I think that the applications would double.
Dale Desautels, President, AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our discussion about the dangers of privatization in the federal government with AFGE Transportation Security Administration, Local 1120 Montana Vice President Eric Wood.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined now by Eric Wood, the Vice President of Montana for AFGE's TSA Local 1120. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We've got you here at AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference in Washington. What have you done so far this week?
Mostly we've been in a bunch of different conferences and stuff. We're discussing some of our new techniques that we're going to take back to the locals to be able to start doing some of that grassroots stuff towards the election coming up. Tomorrow I'm sitting down to meet with our senators and our representative for the state of Montana as well.
How important is it for you and your fellow TSOs to have a presence on Capitol Hill to speak to your representatives in Congress and the Senate?
I think it's very important on any state. Doesn't matter whether we're talking to Republicans or Democrats. We are labor. We are not the Democratic Party. We are not the Republican Party. We want all of them, both senators and congressmen, to hear what labor has to say about the issues at hand, especially with the pay freezes that they're trying to reenact, especially with, like, for TSA, with now that the FAA bill passed that is raising the specter of privatization again within TSA, even though our director Pistol has said that that's not something he really wants to look at and go that direction. We have mostly congressmen, Congressman Micah especially as being one of them, that is heavily pushing that issue very far forward.
Let's talk about that privatization issue for a moment. How important is it for our nation's airports to remain under federal watch?
I think that's something that's very, very important. I think it's critical that for a security agency to be able to flow information very quickly and very rapidly from one area to another. If we compartmentalize it into different groups so that if the agency wants to put something out, if it has to filter through two or three different layers before it reaches the people actually in the field, we have a chance of losing valuable time. We have a chance of actually losing the information completely and not getting it done. Where if we're one solid agency, we can very rapidly mobilize that information and actually do some good with that.
What are some key issues, critical issues, that you're facing at your airport in Montana?
Part of our critical thing is our airport director is still trying to opt us out of the federal screening thing. She has been working actively for the last 4 years to attempt to get us removed from the federal screening and put into a private contractor. So our federal jobs are literally at risk. Her response to one of our people asking says, well, if I want to keep my federal job, she says, well, you can move. You can just, doesn't matter that you've raised your family here, doesn't matter any of that sort of stuff. They literally just don't care. And it's like, you can go away.
And so how important is it then for the labor movement to have a presence there, for AFGE to be on site representing the employees?
It's highly important. One of the things that happened once we were first brought with that was we realized that we needed to have a voice in D.C. that was larger than just the 40 screeners there at that airport. So we unionized. We came and literally came to AFGE and said, we need help. And literally within that first day, AFG was there fighting for us before any of us had signed any paperwork saying we wanted to be members. AFG went out of their way to say, we're not going to have these federal jobs at risk. We're going to do everything in our power to fight for them.
And how has the airport responded to the presence of the union?
The airport does not like us. The airport does not like the fact that we fought back and won. We literally, Pistol said no to her application for privatization. She is in the process of reapplying for that again. And so during this time, we'll take the opportunity to talk to our senators to say, we would like you to talk to Pistol and tell him that you would like to see these airports remain federalized.
What kind of response are you expecting when you go to Capitol Hill to meet with your legislators?
Actually, a fairly good response. We've maintained a very positive relationship with our senators and congressmen, knowing full well that we have to be heard, but within that we have to be respectful. And so we might not necessarily agree with everything that the senator has done or said, but on these issues, we want to come forth and say, here's where we need you, and this is how we need your help. If you do that, most of the time, your senators are more willing to listen to you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Eric Wood, the vice president of Montana at the 1120 local TSA local in Montana. Eric, what are the implications of a pay freeze on the morale of the agency?
I think it's very detrimental. I think people are starting to realize that a pay freeze, and we're coming up on our second year of a pay freeze right now, and they're looking to extend it to a third year, which is highly egregious in my opinion, because that pay freeze for 3 years is, or 2 years even, we're going to feel that effect for the rest of our careers. That is going to continue to snowball because you're never, ever going to get that back. And so when you come down and they say, well, your retirement is, you know, balanced on the highest 3 years of your work or on the highest five, if they change that too. If they've already cut 3 years out of yours, guess what? That's 3 years of your highest pay that you will never reach. So literally your retirement just got shaved by 3 years.
Take us through the pass system. That was obviously a concern for the employees and something that they wanted to have addressed. Tell us a little bit about your feelings on that.
Pass, unfortunately, is a way of for them to say, here we have a way, well, we're going to have to test people to make sure that they're still qualified every year. And we all agree, pretty much there isn't a TSO out there who will not say that we should be certified every year. We should go through some form of testing. But to then say, oh, well, we're going to hang your pay raise. We're going to hang your bonus. We're going to hang all this on this pass. And that is going to account for literally 80% of your evaluation. 20% is going to come from how your supervisor feels about you. And the other 80% is going to literally come for how you do one day. Today, you may have a bad day, you may come in and maybe had a fight with a wife, and your head's not 100% in that game, and they're going to say, oh, you got a test. Or maybe you have problems with testing, you get test anxiety. And so it's highly subjective, and it's highly unfair to an employee to say, oh, well, I'm sorry, you're just not going to get that bonus increase because you didn't do so well. We understand we should be certified, we understand that. A law enforcement officer can go out, he can test at the gun range, and he can fail, and he can test 4, 5, 6 times until he actually shows that he has that competency with that firearm, and he's perfectly fine. The other thing is with us, if you do not do it within one time, now you go back and you remedial, you come back, you test again, you miss that, you come back, you miss a third time, your job is done. You're automatically terminated, you're sent down the road.
How long have you been with the agency?
I've actually been since the beginning. I was October of 2002 when I came on with TSA.
And what led you to become a transportation security officer?
Actually, 9/11, I was saddened to see what had happened. I had been, both my wife and I had spent time in Europe and knew that it was truly sad that we had to see such death for the American public to suddenly realize that they actually had to have some better security going on. And within that, I decided I wanted to be a part of that and help that progress forward.
And then what made you jump into the labor movement?
There again, that was probably brought about by the SPP and the privatization of our jobs was what forced me to say we needed a bigger voice than just the 40 of us and our families. We needed somebody on our side that could speak for a much larger audience.
And ultimately, what are you expecting out of 2012 for the agency and for your union?
For that, I'm very hopeful for a contract. We're sitting down, actually, at the end of this month, we're going to start bargaining our first contract with TSA, and we're looking forward to that being a very positive fruition of many years of working with trying to find a balance between management and labor there. With the election, we're hoping to see another 4 more years where we can be able to move forward and hopefully build our economy back up.
Eric Wood, the Vice President of Montana for AFGE's TSA Local 1120. Eric, thanks for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Department of Defense Local 2142 President Joe Gonzalez will discuss the union's work on behalf of its members.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more. Visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined now by Joe Gonzalez, our good friend from AFGE Local 2142. He's the president of that DOD local. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. I've got so much to tell our brothers and sisters out there and AFGE.
Let's start with some of that. What's happening for you down there in Texas?
Well, let me start by saying we've had a great year. Of course, we've implemented the partnership council there that has never gone away with our new command there at the Corpus Christi Army Depot where I work. Along the way, this past year, we were able to give the employees quite a few different type of awards. And these were basically cases that we had going for the employees out there. For instance, I got them a $3.7 million award for the sheet metal mechanics out at the Corpus Christi Army Depot. This was divided among approximately 360 employees. So they had a good Christmas. Along the way, also, I did get $177,000 $1,000 settlement on a case that I ran for the GSs there on the FALSA case on exempt versus non-exempt. Great case. Right now, I'm in the process of the people that were not, how should I say, given a settlement to try to make their case as to why they should be exempt versus non-exempt.
Talk about some of the work that went into getting those settlements for the employees.
Tremendous amount of work. These were cases that have been going probably for a good year, year and a half. For instance, the guards, we got them a settlement of $45,000 that was split up by approximately 18 guards. They range from as low as $0 to $3,000 payout for those individuals. And of course, we have in our partnership a bonus plan versus the pay for performance. And this past year, because of all the hard work that my bargaining unit did in support of the soldiers out in the field, I was able to come to an agreement with the agency, and each bargaining unit employee in November received $2,400 apiece, approximately about $7.6 million that went out in payouts to the employees out there.
These awards that you've detailed for us, what does that do for the morale of the workforce?
Well, I can remember, I've been president of this local now for the past 17 years. I started back in 1995 with approximately 500 members. I am now at 2,100 members in the local. So it's made a difference not only in the morale, but in the eyes of the employees that the union is there and it is helping and making sure that safe and healthy working environments are provided for them.
How is your relationship with management these days?
Well, I'm not going to say it's the greatest, but every day is a new day. Every day that we go and meet with management, it's something that you can't agree on everything. But as long as you're able to disagree agreeably, you can go on. And that's exactly the attitude that we have at the Corpus Christi Army Depot. We work for our jobs to make sure that they're there. We're very fortunate that in this particular day and age, we're actually hiring. So I feel very, very good about the relationship that goes on at the Corpus Christi Army Depot. Like I said, we have good days, bad days. We take it one day at a time. And I can tell you right now, it's probably one of the best times ever.
In Washington, there's a contentious battle over the role of federal employees, the size of the workforce, the services that are provided. As a longtime federal employee, how does it make you feel to hear some on Capitol Hill say the workforce should be smaller or the work isn't that significant?
Coming in office in 1995 compared to today, I can tell you that the workforce is smaller. It has been constantly shrinking over the years. In 17 years of my being in office and 17 years of coming up here to Washington, D.C., I think this is the most, how should I say, anti-federal employee time than ever before that I've witnessed in all my years coming up here to Washington, D.C. I can tell you that they cannot continue to try to shrink this government. You know, I am also the president of the Hispanic Coalition, and one of the hardest things that's going to be facing these candidates and our president is immigration. People cannot understand why people want to come and work here and send money back to their homes, because that's exactly what happens. These people are not coming here to live. They're coming here to work for us. If we keep shrinking the government, this problem is only going to get worse. When you start shrinking those employees that do the passports, that make sure that those paperwork that is needed in order for them to be able to come over and work in the United States, if we don't have the people to be able to process that paperwork, things get worse. We need to be able to sustain and keep what we have, and if not, make it stronger for us.
What are you doing as a local leader at AFGE to fight back against these attacks against federal employees?
I, too, have a hard time. I come from the state of Texas. Texas is very anti-union. If you didn't realize, you probably heard Governor Perry. Very anti-union, very hard to get along with. I can only tell you that as we move forward, we have to make an effort to reach out. If we don't reach out, then we're just as bad as they are. If they don't respond to us, well, that's fine and dandy. At least we've made our position known to these legislators.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Joe Gonzalez, president of AFGE's DOD Local 2142 in Texas. Joe, what's your top priority in 2012?
In 2012, my top priority is to make sure that President Obama is reelected, first of all. Second, I know it's a big dream, but I would love to see the state of Texas turn from red to blue. Easier said than done, but I can tell you that we're going to give it our very best try. I just got voted in as the Coastal Bend Central Labor Council president, and I've got a great amount of leaders in the Central Labor Council, and we've vowed all together that we're going to do our very best to make sure that we get our share of legislators, Democrat legislators, that support our views as union in office.
Speaking of legislators, of course, this week is the 2012 AFGE Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. What are you hoping to achieve this week as you take your members up on Capitol Hill?
To make sure that the voice of AFGE is heard on the Hill, to make sure that all our brothers and sisters, whether you're VA, SSA, are all heard and show the importance of what we do for our citizens in this great nation.
Joe, how important is it to have a strong presence on Capitol Hill for an organization like AFGE?
Very, very important. I think that over the years, this particular process has done nothing but improve the position and the recognition of AFGE and what we do for the employees within the federal government.
When you visit your members of Congress and they know that hundreds, if not thousands, of members are standing behind you each and every day, what message does that send to them?
It sends a message that they need to be cautious of what they do and how it affects each and every one of us as in federal employees. We are their watchdogs. The $200 hammer didn't come from somebody buying a $200 hammer. It came from a federal employee that was looking out for the taxpayers' money, and that's what we are. We are the eyes and ears of the taxpayers.
From Washington back to Corpus Christi, what are some of those top issues that you face at the Corpus Christi Army Depot?
Some of the top issues, of course, is the continuing of workload, the capacity of our facility. We're an aging type of facility. We need new infrastructure. We need money allocated in order for us to be able to continue to support and maintain the equipment that is needed by the soldiers in the field. And as time goes on, these facilities are starting to run down. So we need new capital investment in all DOD in order to be able to continue to maintain these equipment that our soldiers use and need out in the field.
When you communicate with management, do they understand your concerns about the workload at the Army base?
Very much so. I am very much involved in all aspects of the business within the Corpus Christi Army Depot. I know exactly what the strength is as far as the members. I know what exactly the workforce versus workload is needed in order for us to be able to accomplish the mission, not only for that day, but for the year.
As you're looking beyond 2012, what do you hope to accomplish there at the Army base?
Stability, to be able to make sure that that particular type of industry is there for many, many years to come. And, of course, for the future of our sons and daughters, especially those that have served.
Joe Gonzalez, president of AFGE's DOD Local 2142, the Corpus Christi Army Depot. Joe, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for giving me the time. I needed to get the message out to the people. And to my brothers and sisters out there, don't give up. We're united. It's united we stand, divided we fall.
Thank you to our guest this week, Food and Water Watch senior lobbyist Tony Corbo, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel, TSA Local 1120 Montana Vice President Eric Wood, and DOD Local 2142 President Joe Gonzalez. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shop.